I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Now, Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. Here's your host, KMOX Health Editor, Fred Bottomer.
Hi there. Thanks a lot for joining me again today. I really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. Lots to talk about today, including a closer look at America's obesity epidemic. Apparently, it's getting worse. We'll also talk with a cardiologist about uncontrolled hypertension, and we'll raise some awareness about pediatric cancer. But first, let's start the show the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure.
Let's get up to date on the COVID restrictions in St. Louis County. This past week, St. Louis County Executive Sam Page announced he was going to lift some of the youth sports restrictions.
Effective Monday, we are changing our guidelines to allow games and high-frequency contact sports for children under 14 and in middle school with some restrictions. That means sports such as football, basketball, ice hockey, and wrestling, competitive games will be allowed for middle school and kids 14 and under. We will also allow all students, including high school students of any age, to play competitive games and moderate contact sports. This includes sports such as soccer, baseball, cheerleading crew, rowing, dance team, floor hockey, field hockey, lacrosse, and racquetball. We expect that in the next 2 or 3 weeks, we can issue a document that sets up conditions for high contact high school sports to be played safely in our community.
But no high school football yet. What do you think of this decision?
Well, I think it's good. I want to kind of set the stage a little bit and just say, you know, this is, you know, because the county and city have been, I think, more in line with CDC recommendations about face mask and social distancing, kind of in terms of a mandate within the community, I think this has really leveled off the amount of, particularly has leveled off the growth of COVID, certainly. Again, as we said before, we still have cases, but the growth or the increase of cases has certainly plateaued, if not gone down. And as a result of what I would say is good policy, we now can start talking about liberalizing some of these restrictions. And I just want to applaud the sequence of decisions that have allowed us to be at this point. And I think this is the right decision. The time is such that we can start to, you know, slowly kind of get back to normal, and it's going to come in steps, and there's going to be hiccups along the way, and we've just got to work through it. But I think this kind of moderate response to allow people to do things that are, you know, probably a little less risky than others is kind of the good first step.
Earlier this week, Missouri Governor Mike Parson and his wife Teresa tested positive for COVID-19.
From day one, we have encouraged everyone to wear a mask. The Kansas City Star writes an article and says the anti-mask governor, which is just totally false and biased. We have always recommended people wearing masks back since March. I did it every day, and we'll continue to do that. I do think it's that. We really try to watch our social distancing. 6 feet, being around no more anybody than 15 minutes. That's kind of a policy we have in place at the governor's office.
Dr. Buchholz, what's your reaction? And talk to us about contact tracing.
Yeah, so first of all, I wish the governor and his wife the best with health, and hopefully they have a speedy recovery. It sounds like they're doing okay, which is good. And you know, again, I you know, policy and politics aside, I think your heart breaks anytime is infected with this, and you know, the concern of always that they don't have any severe effects from this is my fervent hope and wish for anybody. I will say, from contact tracing, and again, this is a highly visible public figure, and so, you know, depending on how often this person interacts with other people, particularly in a physical presence, is I think a question. And you know, this is where when you have kind of a high profile person that may have a lot of contact with others, this is where you have to kind of sort through who's been involved with them, who's worked closely with them, who shared, you know, the same physical space, if not, you know, a long amount of time with them, and, you know, decide whether or not they need to be tested or not. And, you know, let me just say, the other thing with this is that the testing, we've talked about this multiple times, is very, very good. If it's positive, it's very helpful. If it's negative, it doesn't help you a whole lot. So even with negative testing, there are some quarantine rules in place. If you've had close contact with somebody that has been positive for a while, you know, certainly need to monitor symptoms. And, you know, there's guidance that says, you know, you want to self-quarantine until you're symptom-free for about 7 days. And that guidance has continued to change a little bit. And, you know, kind of controversially, the CDC came out with some refined rules in the last couple of weeks. But, you know, I still think that's if you can afford to do that, still would recommend to do so if you had close contact with somebody that's positive.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. This past week, Dr. Buchholz, Dr. Anthony Fauci testified again before a Senate committee, and he brought up the issue of long haulers.
A number of individuals who virologically have recovered from infection, in fact, have persistence measured in weeks to months of symptomatology that does not appear to be due to persistence of the virus. They're referred to as long haulers. They have fatigue, myalgia, fever, and involvement of the neurological system, as well as cognitive abnormalities such as the inability to concentrate.
Have you treated any long haulers, Dr. Buchholz?
You know, I have not. I did have a resident that was infected and really felt, you know, his symptoms lasted much longer than the duration of the virus. So, I mean, that's probably the closest I've personally come to that. But, you know, I will say with other viruses as well, this is a known fact. Infectious mononucleosis can cause fatigue for a long period of time. I've seen a lot of other people with viral illnesses that will have, particularly respiratory viral illnesses, who will have kind of longstanding effects for weeks, if not months, after the infection. So none of this surprises me. And again, I think it just shows in the midst of a pandemic, you know, kind of going back to the comment about the governor, I should say, or would neglect to say, is this affects everybody. And even if it doesn't affect you directly, you know, the fact that you or a loved one may get sick, they may not get very ill with the kind of the acute phase, but they may have long-lasting effects way after the fact. You know, they are chronically fatigued or they have a hard time concentrating is profound. And still that extent is still something we don't know about the damage to our population that COVID has caused, aside from the 200,000 deaths we're at right now.
This is kind of an odd story, but I imagine you probably have a comment about it. A man in Massachusetts has died, and it's prompted a warning about eating too much black licorice.
A 54-year-old Massachusetts man died of heart failure after eating a bag and a half of black licorice every day for several weeks. That's according to a report in the New England Journal of Medicine. The man, identified by doctors only as a construction worker with a, quote, poor diet, suffered a sudden cardiac arrest in a fast food restaurant and died the next day. A cardiologist at Massachusetts General Hospital says that eating even a small amount of licorice can increase your blood pressure. Jim Crisula, CBS News.
Talk with me about licorice and blood pressure.
Sure. So I think the first rule I always talk about this is, again, everything in moderation is usually okay. Things on the extreme is usually not okay. And this is just a tragic, unfortunate example of that rule. So, you know, in black licorice, there's a substance called, and if I butcher this pronunciation, forgive me, Fred, but glycyrrhizic acid, that is one of these things that's found in a lot of different things, and on small doses probably has very little effect, but it can alter and increase your blood pressure. And I think more importantly, at higher doses or higher amounts, can reduce an electrolyte called potassium, which is a very highly regulated electrolyte in our body. And when you have abnormally low levels or abnormally high levels, can cause changes to your heart conduction, electricity of that forces your heart to basically squeeze consistently, you know, 60, 100 times a minute, 24 hours a day. And so that's what happened with this individual is that low potassium led to an arrhythmia, and it was probably what he died from. But when it comes to blood pressure, same thing. When you have changes in potassium, it also alters how your sodium is affected in your body, and that can lead to changes in blood pressure, certainly. All these things are kind of directly related. And again, just, you know, if you have a bite of black licorice here and there, I don't know why you would find that tasty, but that's a different story. But, you know, everything in moderation is fine. But, you know, again, this person was at the extreme and unfortunately had a horrific event occur with that.
Dr. Buckle, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it again.
Yeah, my pleasure, Fred. Thank you.
Dr. Fred Buckle is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up on Health Matters, we'll talk with a local bariatric surgeon about America's obesity epidemic. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. The U.S. adult obesity rate now stands at nearly 42.5%. It's the first time the national rate has passed the 40% mark. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Aaron Borenstein. Dr. Borenstein is a bariatric surgeon with SSM Health Weight Management Services. Dr. Borenstein, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What more can you tell us about these latest numbers?
Well, I think it is very indicative of what people are struggling with on a day-to-day basis. But, you know, now you throw in the pandemic that we're currently going through with COVID-19, and, you know, everyone's lives have been turned upside down, you know, that they can't be as physically active as they would like to be, you know. And I think a lot of people are going through issues with depression, anxiety about the future, and a lot of people tend to turn to food for comfort during those times.
COVID pandemic aside, what are some of the other reasons you think obesity rates continue to go up?
Well, I think in general, as a society, you know, we are not as physically active as we used to be many generations before us. But it, you know, the obesity pandemic that we are seeing is a very multifactorial thing. There's genetics involved in it. Obviously, our lifestyle habits, being our exercise habits and our food, all play a role in our obesity in our country.
What's the impact of obesity on our health?
So obesity is one of those things that affects all the organ systems of the body. You know, people who are obese tend to have, you know, more instances of high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes. There's increased risk of fatty liver disease that can eventually lead to liver cirrhosis if not taken care of appropriately. And then as well, I mean, there's, you know, obesity is a very well-known risk factor for a whole laundry list of different types of cancer throughout the body.
And what's the impact of obesity on COVID-19 risk and adverse outcomes?
So, you know, we are certainly learning more throughout this whole process, but some of the early reports have certainly demonstrated that people with obesity tend to have more morbidity with it, meaning adverse outcomes. They have a higher chance of death if they do contract the virus, and that's typically for those people who are so sick that they require ventilatory support, and it becomes much more difficult to ventilate a patient who is overweight. So there's a lot of pressure and force on the lungs to expand, and it becomes more difficult to ventilate those patients.
Is childhood obesity also on the rise?
It certainly is, and I think that is, you know, one of those aspects where genetics certainly plays a role, but also, you know, the lifestyles that the parents adopt, usually the kids are also prone to, obviously, because they're growing up in the same family. So they eat the same food that mom and dad eat. They have typically the same type of activity level that mom and dad have. There's certainly a higher rate of sedentary children, I think, with all of the online things and resources that are available to them and all the online gaming and such.
We're talking with Dr. Aaron Borenstein. Dr. Borenstein is a bariatric surgeon with SSM Health Weight Management Services. Dr. Borenstein, how do we address these increasing rates? What should we be doing?
So, I mean, the best thing that we can do is, you know, trying to be as physically active as possible, you know, ideally 4 to 5 times a week, you know, about half an hour to an hour a day, to where, you know, you're really kind of increasing that heart rate and getting up to a goal heart rate, you know, not just a leisurely walk around the neighborhood, but some real strenuous physical activity, but also looking at the foods that we're eating. So, you know, staying away from, you know, high sugar, high fat foods, more complex carbohydrates. So, you know, a lot of that is, you know, diet related that we can change, as well as, you know, our physical activity. But, you know, it, even with those changes, it can be very difficult, depending on how overweight the patient is, to really make a lot of headway as far as weight loss.
If that's the case, tell us about bariatric surgery.
So bariatric surgery is, you know, probably the best option for people who are morbidly obese. You know, there are several different types of bariatric surgeries that we do. The sleeve gastrectomy, the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, the duodenal switch. You know, and all of these patients that come in to see us have usually struggled with their weight for many, many years, have tried many, many different types of diets, exercise programs, and they may have had some success, you know, lost 20, 30 pounds here or there, but most of them will gain that weight back pretty quickly after they stop, you know, whatever fad diet that they or exercise program that they're following. And so they have this yo-yo type effect where they are going up and down as far as their weight goes. So weight loss surgery gives us the best long-term chance of helping people get the weight off that they need to get off, as well as helping them keep that weight off for the long term.
And there are very few safety concerns these days with bariatric surgery?
Yes, so bariatric surgery is just as safe as any of the other operations that we do. You know, we do all these operations in a minimally invasive manner now, so they're very small incisions. There's no longer the old-fashioned big open incisions. It's almost unheard of for anybody to, you know, die from bariatric surgery. Certainly, there are complications with bariatric surgery that can arise, just like any other operation that somebody might have, but those risks are significantly smaller than they used to be.
Dr. Borenstein, what's the main message you want to get out there?
The main message that I want to get out is that bariatric surgery is a great option for those people who have struggled with their weight and have struggled with their weight for quite a while. It's a safe option. There's many different options depending on what the patient is struggling with as far as their health problems. But, you know, at the same time, this is a tool that we can give to people to help them get their weight back on track.
Dr. Borenstein, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
Dr. Aaron Borenstein is a bariatric surgeon with SSM Health Weight Management Services. Coming up on Health Matters, is your blood pressure under control? For many of us, it isn't. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, Back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health, on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. A new report finds uncontrolled hypertension is on the rise in America. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Stephanie Windisch. Dr. Windisch is a SLU care cardiologist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Windisch, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So tell us, what did this study find?
The study showed that over the course of the period that they monitored and followed patients, patients were having more instances of higher blood pressure that was harder to control.
And what's the danger of that?
So blood pressure is a long-term goal. There's concerns over time if blood pressure is not controlled, it can lead to heart disease, which is my area of interest, as well as stroke, kidney disease, blindness, and a lot of other cardiovascular complications and long-term issues that affect quality of life.
In this day and age, it's also a risk for COVID-19?
High-risk patients for COVID-19 do include people with hypertension as well as heart disease. So, yes, this is something that people need to take seriously in terms of their long-term health benefits and their health in general that can predispose them to conditions such as COVID-19 or other infections.
Dr. Windisch, why do you think this is happening? Why the increase in uncontrolled hypertension?
So the factors that contribute to high hypertension and uncontrolled high blood pressure are really things that we're going to see affecting us long-term with the aging of the population in the United States, as well as the lack of physical exercise, the poor diet, and the obesity epidemic. We see people getting high blood pressure as they age. That's something that we can't change. Aging is a good thing. We can't change our genetic predisposition, but what we are seeing is that people, as you get larger and bigger and more obese, you have higher chances of high blood pressure, and it becomes harder to control.
What are the warning signs we should be on the lookout for when it comes to high blood pressure? It's also called the silent killer, isn't it?
Hypertension is the silent killer because you don't really feel anything until you start to feel bad. And at that point, it can become dangerous. When you're feeling a normal day in, let's say you're 25 and then all of a sudden you're 50 and you're diagnosed with hypertension, in that meantime, you probably don't feel anything. What you need to do is work on the long-term goal. But if you are having problems where you're having a headache, blurry vision, chest discomfort, shortness of breath out of the ordinary, that could be signs of a life-threatening hypertensive emergency, and that would be time to seek medical attention.
What can we do to avoid high blood pressure?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and it's something that I'm very interested in discussing and preventing cardiovascular disease and death. What we can do, like I mentioned, we can't prevent aging and we can't prevent our genetics, but what we can do is try to maintain an active lifestyle, getting 30 minutes of exercise at least 5 times a week, including strength training. We can eat a well-balanced diet, whatever that is. If you choose to be vegan, vegetarian, eat meat, any of those things are okay as long as you do it everything well-balanced, avoid excess salt, and, you know, really try to maintain a goal weight that's in a healthy range.
Does high blood pressure affect any group more than another?
Yes, it's definitely higher or disproportionately affects African Americans as well as Hispanics, but to a greater extent, African Americans.
We're talking with Dr. Stephanie Windisch. Dr. Windisch is a SLU care cardiologist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Windisch, what's a good blood pressure reading?
So the goal and the definition of a normal blood pressure reading is 120 systolic over 80 diastolic, and that's where we aim to be as close to that as possible.
And what do those numbers mean?
Systolic, the top number, is the pressure of your heart when it squeezes out to the body, and the number on the bottom is our diastolic blood pressure, the number of the pressure in the chamber of the heart when it's filling.
Should we be taking our blood pressure at home?
That's a discussion that you should have with your primary care doctor or your cardiologist. If you have worrisome symptoms or signs, predisposition, meaning family history, increased stress, obesity for hypertension, it's not something that would hurt, especially if you're trying to change medications or deciding if you're going to start therapy for hypertension. Getting a good handle on what your blood pressure is doing consistently is a good idea. I wouldn't recommend every single person just go out and start checking their blood pressure every day, though. It would be a discussion with your doctor.
Let's talk about treating high blood pressure. What can we do? What medications are out there?
Yeah, that's a really great question as well. The goal is initially prevention and non-pharmacological treatments. Like we talked about, a lot of the factors contributing to hypertension are based on lifestyle. So the first goal is always to maintain that healthy weight. It's shown that if you lose 1 pound of weight, your blood pressure can decrease by 1 point. So if you're 20 pounds overweight, your blood pressure is 20 points higher. That's a great thing that you can do without taking medications. If you do need to add a medication because you've tried all the appropriate steps and just haven't been able to get it to goal, there's many classes of medicines that we use, and they're tailored to each patient's other specific needs and preferences.
What's your thinking on more than one blood pressure medication? Is that needed, and is that helpful?
It's very dependent on the patient, their comorbidities, and how their blood pressure responds. There's a lot of things that one patient may respond very well to a small dose of one medicine, and another patient, based on their own individual factors, may need two or three different classes or types of medicine. So it really is patient-dependent. To get us to that long-term goal of 120 over 80 and, long, healthy life.
Let's go back to COVID-19 and heart problems. What are we seeing there?
A lot of what we do and don't know about COVID-19 is very much evolving. But what they have shown and what we have seen is that patients who have underlying health conditions, including heart disease, hypertension, risk for heart failure, do worse if they get COVID-19. Having hypertension is not a predisposition to getting it. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to catch it or end up very sick. It just is something that we're seeing in correlation. So we're not able to show that hypertension or heart disease causes COVID-19 or predisposes you to it. We are seeing that if you have these conditions, you're at a higher risk for doing poorly with the disease.
How concerning is it to you to hear that there are cases of heart problems in people who have recovered from COVID-19 a few weeks or months down the road?
Yeah, it's actually very interesting. There's a lot of studies and a lot of data coming out that we don't really know why this happened. And it's just something that as a scientific community, as a cardiology community, as a concerned citizen of the world during a pandemic, it's something that needs a lot more research and a lot more care, but it is something that's concerning. And I'll be interested to see what the studies show long term about these effects and how we best treat patients.
Dr. Windisch, we've been talking about uncontrolled hypertension. What if you have well-controlled hypertension or high blood pressure and you're taking medication? Does that still mean that you are high risk for something like coronavirus?
Yes. Yeah. A lot of people say, I don't have high blood pressure because I'm on medicine for it. The underlying mechanism that caused you to have high blood pressure is still there, regardless of your blood pressure readings while you're on these medicines.
Dr. Windisch, anything else you want to add?
I just wanted to say thank you for your time. And this is hypertension and uncontrolled hypertension are things that are very manageable. It takes a good relationship with the patient and the doctor and a little bit of work on both parts. But we want to try to make sure that patients, like I said, have a long and healthy life. We are not succumbed to the silent killer of cardiovascular disease or stroke. And thank you again for your time.
Dr. Windisch, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
Dr. Stephanie Windisch is a SLU care cardiologist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up on Health Matters, we'll talk about kids and cancer. September is Pediatric Cancer Awareness Month. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Pediatric cancer kills more children than any other disease in the United States. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Lauren Draper, Dr. Draper is a SLU care pediatric hematologist and oncologist at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Dr. Draper, thanks for your time.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Draper, how common is pediatric cancer?
You know, it is still relatively rare when we think about diseases compared to like when we see cancers in adult patients, but it still is, it touches so many lives every year. We think about it, you can think about it in big numbers, but I really think about it more on the individual level. And it averages about 43 children are diagnosed with cancer each day, which means every day, 43 parents have to hear some of the worst news about their children. And that average, you know, that's almost 16,000 a year in the U.S. each year are diagnosed with cancer.
Which cancers are most common in kids?
So acute leukemia, specifically acute lymphoblastic leukemia, is the most common pediatric cancer. But brain tumors are second most common after that. And then sarcomas are, you know, solid tumors. And then there's more kind of delineations based on, you know, brain tumors is a big category as far as there's lots of different types with different therapies.
Is there a difference between the way cancer reacts to kids and adults?
Absolutely. It's one of the things that it's probably most frustrating, I think, for anybody that treats cancer or has to go through it with their child is that so much of the funding and medications and everything is really focused on adult cancers. We think about the NCI budget for cancers, only 4% of it goes to pediatric cancers. But pediatric cancers are a different beast. Even the same diagnosis, like acute lymphoblastic leukemia, an adult is treated differently, responds differently, has different cure rates than it does in pediatrics. So we really, the good thing about that is that it also means we cure more children than adults with similar sort of cancers. But we do that with old medicines and old techniques and, you know, really kind of pushing through clinical trials that aren't always, they don't raise as much money for different companies. So it's something that dedicated teams of physicians, of researchers look at pediatric cancer to try to cure it.
Which pediatric cancers are the most treatable or at least the most curable?
That's a little bit of a difficult question to answer because there are some pediatric cancers that you think about at a certain age or at a certain risk category are much more treatable. Acute lymphoblastic leukemia, as our most common, is relatively curable. For a lot of children, but as I tell every parent, unless I can tell you that it's 100%, it doesn't matter. It's even if some low-risk acute lymphoblastic leukemias or ALL has a 95% survival rate, that comes with years of chemotherapy. It comes with a significant risk of long-term side effects from our therapy, and that's still a 5% chance that your child won't survive this long-term. All comers with pediatric cancer, about 84% survive till 5 years after the diagnosis. But almost 60% of children that go through cancer therapy will have what we call late effects, or they will have lingering side effects from their therapy into adulthood.
Dr. Draper, you mentioned that 43 children per day are diagnosed with cancer, and it's a very sad thing when parents have to be told. What's the reaction mainly from parents?
It is typically, you know, disbelief. How are we here? How did this happen? What did I do? And that is often the next thing that I say is, you didn't do anything. You know, there are some adult cancers we can say, oh, you know, lung cancer is associated with smoking and or things like that. Pediatric cancers don't have that cause and effect that we know about. And it's certainly not anything parents did or didn't do that got them to that point. And then generally we sit and we sit there for a minute just to kind of let that news absorb. Unfortunately, with a lot of diagnoses, we have to move fairly quickly. So then, relatively quickly we go from your child has cancer and here are the medicines that I'm going to use to treat it. So it is the first, I think about the first week after a diagnosis is just overwhelming. And the other thing that I reassure parents is we're going to say these things over and over and over. There's very little that they have to remember from that first day, those first days after diagnosis. because we're going to continue to talk about the information. We're just the beginning of our relationship and journey with that family.
We're talking with Dr. Lauren Draper. Dr. Draper is a SLU Care pediatric hematologist and oncologist at SSM Health Cardinal Glenn and Children's Hospital about pediatric cancer. Dr. Draper, how about for those of us that have a relative or a family member that's has pediatric cancer? How do we support the family?
Well, I think that's a great question, because while it is relatively rare, I think most of us will end up being touched by it in some way or another, whether it's a relative or somebody in the community or something like that. One of the things is we talk about don't wait until the family asks for help. They oftentimes don't even know what they need or know that they need help. So go ahead and jump in. Some of that is going to be like, let me bring you food. Let me send you a DoorDash gift certificate while you're sitting at the hospital and you can order food. Helping with laundry at home. It's kind of, I think about like when somebody has a newborn, they don't want you to come to their house and then they have to entertain you. They want you to come while they can take a nap, or while you're cooking dinner, they can play with their other children. All of those sort of things are helpful. In this COVID time period, things look a little bit different. I've had a couple families just recently, communities, you know, join together. They want to do fundraisers. They want to do all these things to help the family, but the family then feels a little bit obligated to show up at maybe a fundraiser, and they don't feel safe being around crowds, and we recommend that they're not there. So being creative about that. Maybe it's a virtual trivia night. Maybe it's a drive-by parade. All of those things are going to be helpful. I also think about, you know, when your own children have a friend that maybe is diagnosed with cancer, making sure that your children are prepared about perhaps some of the side effects, that they may lose their hair, they may be tired, they're missing school differently. But that way, their friendship can just focus on them being kids and figuring out how to play and interact without having to make that this secret subject.
What are some of the big advances lately in pediatric cancer treatments?
A lot of it is looking at how we can use the immune system to target cancer cells. I think, you know, one of the things that we have recently started doing at Cardinal Glennon is what we call CAR T therapy, which is for certain leukemias and lymphomas, which is using the body's own T cells, which is part of the immune system, and manufacturing them to target the cancer cells. Also, some of the clinical trials that we have available look at the genetic changes of the cancer cells themselves, and then we try to highlight medications that are directed and are very specialized for those specific cancer cells within the body, instead of having to use as much, you know, of the traditional chemotherapy when we think about the side effects of fatigue, low blood counts, hair loss, all of those. So being able to use these different techniques is really allowing us to treat cancers in different ways and hopefully with less toxicity.
Dr. Draper, what's the message you want to get out there?
That anybody that is touched by childhood cancer doesn't have to do it alone. They have an entire community at the hospital, in their community, you know, whether it's their school, their church, their town, all of those things that are going to be there to support them through this journey. That is hard and not easy, but we're going to be there for you. And we all need to talk to our legislators about increasing funding for childhood cancer so that this becomes a problem of the past.
Dr. Draper, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Lauren Draper is a SLU Care pediatric hematologist and oncologist at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. And that's all the time we have for today's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If there are parts of this show you want to hear again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. Or you can download the Radio.com app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.